Okay, so I decided perhaps I should give a bit of a review of some of the ways vertex algebras appear in gauge theory and are potentially related to Cauchy. So first of all, let me remind you of some basic facts about supersymmetric gauge theories and how to twist them. So in supersymmetric quantum field theories, they're typically given a bunch of fermionic generators, which are symmetries of the theory and anti-commute to some linear combinations of the translation generators. Now, twisting a theory means that you pick some specific linear combination of the supersymmetry generators such that squares to zero and take the Q cohomology. So instead of looking at all possible correlation functions, you only look at correlation functions of local operators which are annihilated by Q. And then things that are Q-exact drop out from correlation functions, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the properties of this twisted quantum field theory depend a lot on what sort of, what's the image of the other supersymmetry generators under the action of Q. Because you see, if all the translation generators are in the image of Q, then translating something is an exact operation. Moving a local operator around your correlation function is a Q-exact operation, has no effect. So if all translations IQ exact, you have a TFT, a topological field theory. Correlation functions are independent of the position of the operators, simply because if you take some local operator which is annihilated by Q, and you look at the derivative of that operator, that's a commutator between a translation and your operator. Or you can rewrite it as, write it like that. It's something too exact. By using Jacobi. That's why this is usually called topological twists. Something like this is called a topological twist. It's an operation you do on a supersymmetric quantum field theory that gives you a topological field theory. There are other possibilities. For example, it might be that you have some complex structure and that the anti-holomorphic derivatives are exact, but not the holomorphic derivative. Then you get a holomorphic theory. Where correlation functions of Q-closed operators depend meromorphically on their arguments. And there you can have a hybrid situation where some directions of the manifold are topological, some directions are holomorphic. Okay, this is the first point I want to make. If you do when you do twists of a gauge theory, you can get a variety of things depending on which supersymmetry you use. Another observation is that quantum field theories, it is interesting to study defects in quantum field theories. So a defect in a quantum field theory is a local modification say along some R little d inside the space-time where your quantum field theory is defined. A basic property of local a defect, but almost by definition, breaks some of the translations of your theory because it only preserves translations around along the directions it extends along. Let me give examples of local defects. Boundary conditions. A boundary condition allows you to define a theory on R plus times R d minus 1. So you have a defect at the origin of R plus. In general, you might be able to use the boundary conditions to define the theory in a manifold with boundary. Another example, a line defect. Something like a Wilson line. A line defect will modify the theory along some R, some line inside your manifold, your space-time. For example, if I want to have a line defect will be simply, in space-time, it's simply something, some modification of the theory at a point in space, extended in time. I take the Hamiltonian of my theory and I just change it a little bit in the neighborhood of a point in space. This gives me a defect, a line defect in the theory. Now, what's interesting about defects is that, so I say they break some translations, so they have to break some supersymmetries, but they might also preserve some of them. So a defect might preserve Q. In which case you can insert this defect in calculations in this twisted theory, because Q is still well defined in the presence of the defect. But it might also break some of the other supersymmetries, which might not coincide with the translation that it breaks. So that means it's perfectly possible to have, say, a topological field theory in some dimensions, and a defect, an holomorphic defect. Wrapping some R2 inside RD. So what does it mean? When you have a defect modifies the theory, which means that the sort of questions you can ask in the neighborhood of the defect are different from the questions you can ask away from the defect. So there are the space of local operators you can put in correlation functions at the defect is different from the space of local operators that you can put elsewhere. So it's perfectly possible to say have a situation where correlation functions of operators away from the defect are topological, but these operators live at the defect are only holomorphic. So in a situation like this, you are going to get some local operators which live at the defect, which means they live in two real dimensions, And correlation functions depend on meromorphically on this. And away from the defect, everything is topological. So in this situation, local operators at the defect give a vertex algebra. Which depends on your theory and on your defect. Okay, so this is one general way you can get vertex algebras from quantum supersymmetric quantum field theories. So you can take a quantum field theory in some dimension higher than 2 with a topological twist and ask yourself if it happens to have some two-dimensional defects which are holomorphic. Then you get some vertex algebra there. And this vertex algebra often captures interesting properties of the topological field theory we started with. So now let me give some example. What is a good place to erase? So this is sort of general philosophy. Now I can get a bit more concrete. Yes. It depends a little bit on what exactly you have, but for example, if you have something which is a three-dimensional theory, which is holomorphic in two directions and topological in another direction, you'll probably be able to put it on manifolds which are equipped with some vector field and with a complex structure on the transverse foliation. I think Kevin was studying something like that. But here in this talk, the actual theory is always going to be topological. The only thing that is holomorphic is some defect inside the theory. So it will be defined on a manifold, on a generic manifold which has a codimension, which has a two-dimensional submanifold equipped with a complex structure. So, for example, suppose I have a three-dimensional topological field theory, and I have a two-dimensional defect, holomorphic defect. Funny enough, these things happen a lot, even in the real world, even if you don't twist your theories. For example, things like the quantum Hall effect are precisely described by situations where you have a three-dimensional topological field theory and some holomorphic boundary. But anyway, this can also be obtained in topologically twisted situations, and I'll describe them in a moment. But now I want to describe what's the relation in this case between the topological field theory T and the vertex algebra A associated to it. Okay? So there is a picture that can be useful. So let this be the boundary condition, the boundary. And this is the bulk of the theory. So the topological field theory, imagine this is a fully extended topological field theory. It has a lot of, or maybe not even fully extended, but it is a bit extended. Gives us a lot of things. For example, the topological field theory associates to a circle a category, which is the category of line defects. In T, topological line defects in the theory. Line defects form a category just because if I have two line defects, I can have a space of local operators which interpolates between them. And this is just, you can call this the morphisms from defect 1 to defect 2. So they form a category. Now, three-dimensional topological field theory associates, almost by definition, a category to a circle. That's right. If you take Chern Simons, then you get quantum group representations at root of unity.
This theory will be resuming.
That's right. That's right. So in general, if you have a line in the bulk, it can end at the boundary at a point. So here you'll get some vector space of local operators which can live just there at the location where the line meets the boundary. And it turns out, and this is a module for the other boundary local operators, because you can sort of bring them there. So there is a functor to modules for the vertex algebra modules for A. So this is one of the relations. There is a functor from the category attached to a circle to modules for the vertex algebra. Another thing you can do is to take the boundary to actually be a Riemann surface. So take your manifold to be sigma times R plus. Now suppose I want to start to compute, I want to compute some correlation functions in this setup. To compute correlation functions, I need to tell you which local operators I'm inserting at the boundary, but I also need to tell you something about this semi-infinite direction. I need to give you a state. So the topological field theory associates to every Riemann surface a vector space the space of states or the theory on the surface, when space is a surface. You need to give me, if you give me one such state, then I can compute correlation functions. Now, what is, if I have a vertex algebra, what is the space of possible correlation functions on a surface? It's called chiral cohomology mathematically, or conformal blocks in physics. So we learned that there is a map from the space of states on a surface to the space of conformal blocks for the vertex algebra. The chiral cohomology, factorization cohomology for the vertex algebra on the surface. And these two maps are, this functor and this map are closely related in the sense that I can study correlation functions with line defects. So this surface can have marked points. And I can put modules, I can put line defects as marked points, and this will correspond to conformal blocks in the presence of some modules for the vertex algebra. Also, it's worth saying that often this functor and this map are isomorphisms. But I'm not quite sure exactly what are the conditions that make that happen. But this seems to be the case in all examples I know. For example, you were mentioning Chern-Simons theory and WCW model. It's definitely true that the space of states of WCW of Chern-Simons theory is the same as the space of conformal blocks of WCW, of a chiral WCW model. Or that the space of, you know, both the lines and the modules of WCW are labeled by representations of a quantum group. So typically, these are isomorphisms, although, again, I'm not sure of what is this precise statement. It would be nice to understand when it's the case. And that means that you can use the vertex algebra to learn about the topological field theory, or vice versa. There might be situations where the topological field theory is very hard to study and the vertex algebra is simpler. Although my situation where, you know, the representation theory of vertex algebra might be very complicated, and the topological field theory might teach you about that. For physical theories like Chern-Simons theory, this is always something very nice. There are both modular tensor categories. For topologically twisted supersymmetric theories, you get more general things. Now, let me mention a slight modification of this setup, which is interesting. But first, are there any questions?
When you say vertex algebra, you do not mean chiral. It's a full vertex.
No, I mean a chiral vertex operator algebra. So purely holomorphic with a stress tensor.
Why do you need a stress tensor?
Why do I get it?
Is it guaranteed that
I get it because the bulk is topological, which means a complex structural deformation must be associated to a local operator at the boundary, because only the boundary depends on the complex structure. So the fact that the bulk is topological is what guarantees that I have a stress tensor at the boundary. This will not be true in other situations. For example, if you have an holomorphic boundary in an holomorphic theory, you're not going to get a stress tensor at the boundary. So here we're studying a 3D theory, as I say, on R plus times C. Examples of these theories could be topological twist of so-called 3D n equal 4 theories. Every 3D n equal 4 super n equal 4 theory has two topological twists introduced by Rozansky-Witten for sigma models. And for both, you can sort of do this story and get some boundary vertex algebras. But in order to discuss a potential relation to Koha, although still pretty conjectural, it's useful to sort of lift this picture to 4D n equal 2 as CFTs on a geometry that looks like a cigar times C. So if you have a cigar and you sort of reduce on a circle, you get R plus. So there is some sense in which for the n equal 2 theories on some kind of deformed cigar end up producing vertex algebras too, which morally speaking leave the tip of the cigar. So typically you have some kind of a deformation which works equivariantly along this circle so that you don't get any local operators anywhere except at the fixed points of the equivariant action, which is the tip of the cigar. Now, the reason I'm mentioning it is because this vertex algebra, so the character of this vertex algebra has an interesting expression. It's some kind of a trace in the quantum torus algebra of the of a certain operator acting on the quantum torus, which is the one introduced by Concievich and Soberman in the study of these Calabi-Yau categories, three Calabi-Yau categories. I might be able to get to give more details at the end of the talk, but I just wanted to mention that there is some weird relation between the character of this vertex algebra and something which kind of counts states in a doubled up koha. I have been hoping that there should be some kind of categorification of this statement, which really relates the vertex algebra itself to the double koha. I haven't been able to make the connection yet. But I want to just mention it as something which would be interesting to think about. So let me move on to a setup which it's for which the relation to koha is more well established, and it will be the subject of some of the other talks during the week. So here I was thinking about co-dimensional one places inside three-dimensional space. Now there is something else I can do. I can take a four-dimensional topological field theory and look at some kind of a corner configuration, meaning the theory is defined on R plus squared times C. So I have two boundary conditions, one at the origin of one R plus, and the other at the origin of the other R plus. I assume that these are also topological. But the place where the two boundaries meet, the origin of both R pluses, is holomorphic. This is the context of this sort of vertex algebra at the corner that I mentioned. So again, you're going to get some vertex algebra here. The relations between the vertex algebra and the topological field theory are going to be more complicated, though, because now I have a four-dimensional topological field theory, and not a three-dimensional one. So, for example, a four-dimensional topological field theory will associate to a surface a category . Now the boundary conditions give you objects to this category, in this category. So the topological field theory attaches to sigma times R plus with boundary condition one some object in the category. And to boundary condition two, some other objects in the category. And so now the statement is that the space of morphisms from object one to object two maps to the conformal blocks of the chiral algebra. So a typical example of this, the topological field theory in four dimensions, is the GL twist of any of four supermills with some gauge group G and parameter kappa. So the GL twist gives you a family of topological field theories which depend on a continuous parameter in C. And G is some sort of reductive is the choice of gauge group. Say UN, SP4, whatever. So if you do that, then this category becomes something like twisted in modules for the space of G bundles on your surface. And this construction has all sorts of applications to the geometric Langlands program, quantum geometric Langlands program. So if you pick very specific boundary conditions here, which I will not describe, then the vertex algebra you find is the W algebra for this group at level kappa. Here the objects are something like the D-module. Anyway, that doesn't, I don't, we're not interested in geometric Langlands today, so. What I'm interested in is the fact that here this there is a setup that involves Nicol Fox Superior Mills, which gives me the W algebra at the corner. And that playing around with this setup, I might be able to get all sorts of interesting modules for this W algebra. Now, this picture also has a lift involving some cigars. So you can take the six-dimensional superconformal field theories associated to Nicol Fox Superior Mills. And place them on the product of two cigars. So where each cigar goes down to one of the copies of R plus. Now there are sort of two deformation parameters, one for each cigar. They are kind of Necrasov deformation parameters. They are equivariant. They tell you how equivalently you're working under rotations. And the parameter kappa is the ratio of the two. So this tells you that you can find the W algebra living on a complex plane inside six dimensions if you treat the other four equivalently under rotations. Presumably, this is a big piece of the explanation of the AGT correspondence. Because now you can replace C with some Riemann surface, and you end up having the W algebra on that Riemann surface. When you put the six-dimensional theory on the Riemann surface, you get a four-dimensional theory. And you're working equivalently, you're doing some kind of Necrasov partition function of the four-dimensional theory. And so you end up with some relation between Necrasov partition functions of four-dimensional theories and conformal blocks of correlation functions of W algebras. But in order to discuss the relation to Koha, I don't need to go all the way down to four dimensions. So if we want to study the Fourier modes of a vertex algebra, what do you do? You take you replace C with a cylinder. Right. You take your vertex algebra operator, local operator, and you take Fourier modes. Right. This gives you the modes which actually make up your vertex algebra. So because of that, if you want to sort of represent physically the Fourier modes of the W algebra, you might want to think about the 60 theory on this product of cigars and C star. Now, the six-dimensional theory computified on a circle is supposed to be essentially equivalent to phi dm Mills. Maximum supersymmetric five-dimensional gauge theory. So now I have this five-dimensional gauge theory. I'm treating four directions equivalently. And I get kind of a quantum mechanics in R. Now, one of the most important points of this correspondence is that the Kaluza-Klein momentum, the momentum around the circle, is related to the instanton number in the gauge theory. We call it N. So at the moment, so this picture is suggesting that the modes of the W algebra can be found sort of local operators sitting in along this R inside R times C epsilon 1 times C epsilon 2. And they should act as sort of local operators which increase the instanton number by some amount corresponds to the momentum of the mode. Now, at least for the purposes we are interested in, all that is really left to the five-dimensional gauge theory, once you do this sort of Necrasov deformation, is the dynamics of instantons in the neighborhood of R. So the five-dimensional gauge theory is actually can be essentially replaced by an ADHM quantum mechanics. Something like this. Something associated to this quiver, right? To the one that that Jan just wrote down on the board. And these local operators should appear as sort of correspondence of some sort, which map you from the ADHN with some rank n to some n prime. Now, for reasons I don't understand, it appears that these correspondences can be, the correspondences that that give you the W algebra generators can be represented in terms of these simpler correspondences given by the Koha.
The rank of the charge that they're corresponding to.
Hmm? Sorry?
Maybe the charge that's changing, not the rank?
I mean, this does not change, and this changes. Because this is telling you that you're working with a five-dimensional gauge theory with gauge group un in a sector with little n instantons. So this koha, right, gives you correspondences which change n by sort of, let's say, extending this some quiver representation by a representation of this quiver. Well, so in general, every local operator, if I have some quantum mechanics, if I have two quantum mechanics, supersymmetric quantum mechanics, every supersymmetric local operator that interpolates between one and the other will give you some kind of a correspondence. Now, it seems to so happen that the correspondences that implement these Fourier modes of the W algebra can be built out of these two copies of Koha. Well, so koha gives you something that increases n, right?
Raising a log.
And then, right, there is another copy of koha which lowers n. And these generators, I believe, are built from both, right? I mean, there is the embedding is the algebra embeds in the product of two kohas. Now, I don't know the physical explanation of that embedding. So I do not know physically why these correspondences happen to factor into combinations of koha and inverse of koha correspondences. That I would much like to know. But this is sort of the closest relation between koha and physics that I'm aware of. It happens that in this setup and in the generalizations that will be presented later in the workshop, there are various supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which are all that is left of some higher dimensional quantum field theories. And there are local operators which interpolate between two such quantum mechanics. These quantum mechanics are described by quivers, and these local operators live inside the doubled up koha for these quivers. I mean, they live inside frame quivers. But I don't know why. I don't know why that's actually happening.
So, at this time of the quantum mechanics, are
that's right. That's right.
So you sort of group different quantum mechanics along these local operators.
That's correct. Uh-huh. That's correct. And these local operators are supposed to really satisfy the same algebra as the Fourier modes or the W algebra. But to believe that, you really need to believe that these operators can not only be lifted to five dimensions, but then they can also be lifted to this six-dimensional mysterious theory, which is a very strongly coupled non-Lagrangian theory. And I have no physical intuition of why they can be described through koha. So intuitively, right, this, yeah, I really don't know. I think it's just, I would just leave it at that. I think it would be nice to understand why this is happening.
Does it suggest physically that these W algebra generators factorize or something?
They can be decomposed into simpler things. So the koha kind of gives you a free field realization of the W algebra. And perhaps that's one way one could go to understand why this is happening. There is a whole other question about another observation that made by Miroslav, that all these corner vertex algebras have interesting free field realizations, whose physical interpretation is at the moment quite obscure, but perhaps must have some relation with the appearance of the koha.
So it's not visible
as a localization. Right. So there are a lot of puzzles. There is a skeleton of a relation between physics and the mathematical koha, but I feel that there should be a bit more meat in the correspondence. Of course, I mean, if your objective was just to prove AGT and then you want to show that there is an action of W algebra on the space of instantons or something like that, then passing through koha can just be a tool. But it would be nice if it's not just a tool, if there is some physical, direct physical interpretation of koha. All right, so this was the thing I wanted to say about this setup. Now, are there other questions? I've only given a very broad overview. I expect some of the details will be filled in by later talks.
What if the group is not GLN? So what you said initially makes sense for any group.
That's correct. That's correct.
GLN.
So there should be statements about WG for every Lie algebra. And
You
don't have a quiver.
But you have the same function should fall, yeah?
That's right. you still have some supersymmetric quantum mechanics on the on the moduli space of instantons for that group. It's more singular. And then we see correspondences between these supersymmetric quantum mechanics, which should implement the W algebra for every Lie algebra. I don't know which tools should be used there and that's true. Also, now here you can get a variety of other vertex algebras, right? We're gonna see some, which sometimes can be explained in terms of other quivers. I don't know if all the corner vertex algebras can be explained in terms of quivers associated to appropriate Calabi-Yau's.
Hopefully.
Yes. And as Jan was saying, there are also a variety of interesting modules that you might want to reproduce for these vertex algebras, which have gauge theory interpretations. And I'm not sure if all of them can be gotten to Koha. I did not describe the relation between the modules and the modules of the algebra and the sort of topological field theory data, because it's a little bit more complicated. a topological field theory in four dimension attaches to a circle a true category. Which in this case would be something like the true category that appears in geometric Langlands, on local geometric Langlands. So it's something like the true category of categories with the G of K action, or something like that. And then the boundary conditions associate give you objects in that in the true category, and morphisms between those objects are going to be a category, which should be the category of modules, at least some category of modules for this vertex algebra. Anyway, there is some nice topological field theory story there. I should mention there is actually when I spoke about Banji, I made a certain choice of algebraic structure on the space of flat connections on the Riemann surface. This is kind of a quantization of the space of flat connections on the Riemann surface. You can make other algebraics, other choices of algebraic structure, like the space of local systems, representations of pi 1 of the surface, and the quantization of that. And you get a sort of parallel story, which I think might be of interest to Jan, but I don't think is related to Koha. I don't think I can say something at the board that would be meaning comprehensible. Perhaps as I still have 10 minutes, if there are no more questions, I would go back to the story about Fourdrier and Nicole Chu theories, where the connection to Koha is, as I was saying, is very conjectural and puzzling. So perhaps I can give at least some examples, and maybe somebody in the audience can recognize a story. So, for example, suppose I take the four-dimensional theory whose BPS states are described by a quiver with a single node. I guess I need to double up the quiver. So this physically, this would be the theory of the Fourdrier and Nicole Chu theory of a free hypermultiplet. So the vertex algebra is a beta gamma system. So there is some beta, some gamma, with a very simple OP and dimension 1/2. The character of this algebra is something like this, 1 over the product from n equal to 0 to infinity of 1 plus q to the n plus 1/2 squared. Now, if I remember the board in Young's talk, the koha associated to this is would give me this counting, sorry, minus this counting function. So I had 2 copies of the koha. So question, if I take the koha for 2 copies of the koha for this, can you embed a beta gamma system in there? I mean, can I identify the beta gamma system somehow? I don't know. I don't know enough about koha. Now, there is a generalization of this for essentially all sorts of other quivers, other BPS quivers. For example, if you take this quiver, let me double it up, the 2-node quiver. Double it up. Well, the vertex algebra is supposed to be the simple quotient of Virasoro at c equal to -7/5 or true over 5? I forget, Thomas. The Young Lee model is 22/5, thank you. So it's sort of it's the minimum model, 2.5. The character for the algebra can be computed as follows. Let me take define a quantum dial logarithm as this way. Okay. Then let me take a quantum torus algebra with generators x hat and y hat and write S as the product of phi of x, phi of y hat. I can expand it in positive powers of x and y. Okay. I can do the same with the opposite charges. I get the same pretty much. So these are functions of Q. So it just so happened the character of this algebra is written as what we call a trace on the quantum torus, which is this. why? I'm not quite sure. But pretty much, it looks like I think it's correct that the koha for the 2-node quiver has a generating function which is the product of 2 quantum dialogues. Somebody will have to check me on this. That's right. Well, I whatever potential you put on a doubled up quiver, where you start from this, and you get here. So I guess I do have potential, right? Something like loop 1 AB and loop 2 BA. So I think there is at least a chance that the koha for that has some relation to this. I mean, after all, this is literally the product you would have used in conservation Solomon paper. Right? Although I'm not sure this was the quantum dialogue that was used there. So I'm confused.
Yeah.
But so
it's
Right. Then this is going to be generalized to longer quivers. But again, so this looks like a lot like I take the product to cohas and perhaps restrict on the charge zero sector of that product. And it seems to be the character of vertex algebra. Now, this might be a coincidence, but it could be that the vertex algebra can be actually realized out of this cohas.
Mm-hmm. So is the Gauge theory
in the second example? It's an Argyris-Douglas theory. So it only has two BPS states in a certain chamber, and so has a quiver with two nodes. Examples for gauge theories are more complicated. I can give one in a moment. So similarly, if you look at a quiver, at the doubling up of the A-type quiver, so I just take the A-type quiver and I double it up. So I start from this, right? Yeah. And I add loops and opposite arrows. Okay? Then the corresponding algebra, I think, is another Virasoro minimum model. And the character of the algebra can be written as a product of a bunch of quantum dialogues.
So n is the number of?
Yes, of nodes. I mean, a trace, again, trace of this. Okay, I write S this way, and then I do trace of S as Dagger. Finally, I don't know, another example. If I start from this quiver, and I double it up, this is the first gauge theory example. This corresponds to n equal to star SU2. So SU2 plus one adjoint. And I believe the algebra in this case is n equal 2 super Virasoro at c equal to minus 9. It's a nice vertex algebra. Small super Virasoro. N equal 4, so n equal 4 super Virasoro. And it's equal to minus 9, the nice one, right? Yes. Okay. And again, this is an expression like the character, is an expression like that. So I would like to say that there is something behind this picture, these coincidences. Well, not coincidences. But I don't know a good explanation. I really don't know enough of cohav to know if I can embed a vertex algebra in there. I don't think so. I mean, sorry, I'm not trying to get a module for the vertex algebra, in which case perhaps I would add there is an interesting story about modules of the vertex algebras, but I don't think they involve framing of the quiver. There is a sort of a 2D, what we call the 2D for the well, crossing formula, where these quantum dialogues are replaced by matrices of quantum dialogues. And then the same operation can give you modules of the algebra. So okay, so I'll end my talk here. There are definitely relations between gauge theory, vertex algebra, and cohas, but I don't understand them. I don't understand exactly why are they occurring.
Please. So, any questions?
Mm-hmm. So, where does the square come from?
in the progressive character, as explained.
Yeah, you have S,
so
S plus.
Physically,
it's a sum over squares. Why squares?
So I need to define some kind of a trace on the. I need to give a meaning to an expression like trace of S dagger S.
Yeah.
And S is a sum of monomials with positive, which live in some sort of half of the possible charge lattice. And S dagger is a sum of monomials, which lives in the other half of the charge lattice. And so to define a trace of something like that, I just say I take the sort of formally multiply them and take the coefficient of one. They are in opposite direction, so I don't actually multiply them. I really just take this sum of products. The funny thing is, so the definition is weird, but it still has nice properties. For example, if I conjugate, if I sort of rotate the choice of half the charge lattice, I spit out a quantum dipole from one side and then absorb it into the other side, and the answer is invariant. But it didn't have to be. So although this is not an actual product, it's defined by hand, it behaves in many ways like a product. This will not work for generic expressions, but it works for the specific ones that occur in this formula. So even at the level of the characters, there are formulae that work. I don't quite understand why they work.
Yes.
Yes.
So every vertex produces
one quantum dialogue. In this situation, at least. But in general, is it even true? I think for this situation, it's true. But more generally, you just need to put the product of conservative solvable transformations for the theory.
So is it one big simple group or one that each group? The level of the DBS invariance, you'd expect to see a generator each root in the
Yeah, actually, I don't remember. So
you'd expect to see something. Once you triple it, the DBS invariance it's a 1 for every root to be associated with the algebra. It's not like the single derivative.
There's an easy way to explain why this one. So every representation of this Wheeler is just the extension of representations of Wheeler with one vertex by itself.
Yeah.
So phi of x is just generating function of representations of one point Wheeler.
Yeah.
This product means you take all extensions. And then the scalar
product. You can't wait. You can't. That would be just extending one way.
But
you double the there are extensions both
ways. No, but you want to compute. No, you don't. You see, he has a potential.
Yeah.
So by dimension reduction, you can remove these errors.
Yeah.
So you'll be counting representations of simple realized quiver with endomorphism.
Yeah.
So first, you count all representations of simply less quiver. That's product of the dialogue. And if you want to count endomorphisms, you have to take this scalar product with this trace of S plus S.
Just the level of the generator. This is not the right one. That's one character.
In some moral sense, the elements of the vertex algebra want to be sort of fans of BPS particles. I don't. There is some very vague picture where I have sort of this arch times as the cigar times C. And inside this cigar, there are sort of pictures like this, where to each ray you associate some stable or
a stable
thing, and you want them to be
yeah.
going in some specific way. And for some reason, each operator in the vertex algebra sort of gets associated to one of these fans, and then there might be some.
It's like one from another.
That's right. So half of this fan corresponds to S, the other half to S dagger. But I don't know how to get a vertex algebra structure in the transverse direction.
Is it possible to rewrite this character as a kind of contour integral, like without this trace? But it looks like you take the zero mold of this product, right?
Yes, but
integral of the Hamiltonian of this magic word is a trace of the quantization.
Yeah. Okay. I see. So there is a
exactly the reason. Yes.
Generally, this should be so there is a concrete expression. Okay.
So this sort of
because I thought like if you take a product of something and then you integrate, if the product of something is a product of freely generated things and then you integrate, you mm-hmm. some kind of screening or like reduction of this.
Yes.
So the. Okay.
Now let's thank David again.